everybody. Happy Father's Day. I'm Barbara, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Barbara.
My sobriety date's November 15th, 1998. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor who has a sponsor. I sponsor other women. Excuse me, my home group is Jaywalkers, which meets every Tuesday and Friday at 7. We do have babysitting both nights, and it's set, Tuesday night is a closed discussion, and Friday is an open speaker. So if you're ever in the area, we'd love to have you. And I see some faces that have been down there. Where did the other guy go? You. In the blue. I remember your story. It was awesome. Anyway, so I am here to talk about what it was like and what it's like now. And I hate being late, so I really apologize. Traffic was really bad in Williamsburg coming up here. But anyway, I did not think that I would ever be an alcoholic. My dad was an alcoholic. His dad was an alcoholic. His mother was an addict. My grandmother's brother was an alcoholic. So genetically, I'm hosed. But I never thought that it would ever happen to me. I grew up in just a suburb of Richmond. And the earliest memory I think I have of my dad drinking was literally when he threw me across the room because I accidentally broke a lamp. And I remember, and I got punished for it too, and I remember just the question of what did I do that was so wrong that would happen. You know, like I couldn't figure it out. And I never really saw him drink that much, but I saw the effects of it. Later on, as I got into high school, I would see the bloodshot eyes, the red puffy face, slurred words, barely able to stand. You know, he could be really violent. He flipped over quite a few tables when I was growing up. And I remember thinking, you know, I never want to do that. I never want to be that. He took me into bars when I was really little. And I remember watching him drink, and I was just kind of, you know, I remember growing up looking at it like, I just never want to do that. So at 12, I took my first drink. Because of my dad's alcoholism, we had to move around a lot because he never could hold a job down. And we ended up living with my grandparents, my mom's parents, which was really a godsend. I think it really prevented my brother. I have a younger brother who's 5.5 years younger than me who is an addict. He's just not using right now. He doesn't have a program, doesn't think he has a problem. And I'm like I don't want to even go there with you. But we do have a good relationship. So I can remember seeing a bottle of Tanqueray in this one cabinet in my kitchen. We ended up living at my grandparents' house because my dad's father had passed away, and we were living, I think, in Whitestone somewhere, and came up here, and he went to go live with his mom and help her, and then me and my baby brother, who was an infant, stayed at my grandmother and grandfather's house. And we never lived in the same house again, which I was immensely grateful for that never happened. But I remember seeing this bottle of Tanqueray, and we had one of those old black telephones that you could probably give somebody a concussion if you picked up the receiver and, you know, knocked them on the head. One of those big old black rotary phones they didn't make anymore. And I can remember I kept seeing this bottle, and I wondered what it was. And I specifically remember going to the cabinet, opening it up, unscrewing the top, just swinging it back, putting it back on, sticking it in the shelf, going, that wasn't too bad. When I was younger, I ate a whole bottle of baby aspirin because I liked the way it tasted. I remember where my mom kept them, and I climbed up on the cat and the counter, opened the big cabinet, reached all the way in the back, and got it, and ate the whole bottle. So more is always better. If it tastes good, I want more of it. So that was my first time that I ever drank was when I was 12. And I liked the fact that I got away with it, that nobody knew that I did it. And it was my little secret. And I remember getting that rush from doing something that nobody knows about. You know, like I was, I don't know. So the people that I grew up from, I lived on a dead-end street. It was a pretty long street in this community. And everybody knew everybody else. You know, when I would go out to play when I got up and finished doing my chores, and I did not come back until it started to get dark when I heard my mom call my name. And I felt very safe in that neighborhood. I knew everybody on the street. They knew me. I never worried about, is somebody going to kidnap me like that? I didn't have that growing up. And I had a girlfriend of mine that lived down the street from me, and we're still friends today. So I've known her, God, almost 45 years, which is really scary. And her house was like the safe house to go. Her mother and father Kay's family was like beaver cleaver. I mean, there was no yelling. There was no screaming. There was no drinking. Dad came home every night at the same time. It was just like this idyllic place for me to go and escape to, because my house was the total opposite of that. You know, my dad was very unpredictable. I never knew what was going to happen when I came home. Never knew what was going to happen with him. So what I learned how to do really well is I learned how to manipulate him when he was drinking. I would figure out what kind of mood he was in, and then I would learn to ask certain questions at certain times and try to get what I want doing it that way. But the people lived across the street from me. They had Ramona and Cecilia and Sharon, and they had an older sister. I can't remember who it is, but their mom was Filipino, which to me was exotic because everybody in my neighborhood was white. You know, like they came over on the, you know, whatever's, you know, with Columbus. And so I thought it was really, really cool being over there. And her dad was a really nice guy, but he was an alcoholic. And so there were certain times when we knew we had to stay away from him. And I was really comfortable over there because I knew what that was like. And we got a hold of alcohol somehow, and I don't really remember how, but we were sitting in their parked car in the back seat drinking. And I don't remember how old I was, but I do remember drinking. And then we got out of the car and like shimmied up this little hill, which, I mean, it wasn't even a hill. It was probably just a very slight incline, actually. And thinking that we were getting away with something, you know. And so there was that feeling again of I was getting away with something, you know. School was a safe haven for me because I could go to school and I didn't have to worry about anything. You know, I didn't have to worry about my mom and dad. I didn't have to worry about his craziness. I didn't have to worry about anything. So I started to do pretty well in school because that's where I excelled and that's where I felt really comfortable. My brother was born when I was about 5 and a half. And I didn't find this out until I was older, but my dad was quite promiscuous. And I have several half-siblings that I don't even know who they are until he died, and then I found out who they were because they all showed up at the funeral. And that was fun. So, but I was raised my whole life not knowing that I had other siblings that were there until I went through middle school, and I really, like, I would drink when I could, but, I mean, it was nothing really, you know, amazing. But I also remember always feeling out of place, like I never belonged, and I feel like that sounds so cliche because a lot of people, but I did. I felt like I never belonged. You know, I felt like I didn't fit in. I felt like I wasn't good enough. I wasn't cute enough. I wasn't pretty enough. And then I drank and all that changed, you know? So when I was in middle school, I, made the varsity softball team and I played softball all the way through. I played summer ball. When I got to high school as a freshman, I made the varsity team and that seemed to make my dad happy. And so he started paying a little bit more attention to me because I was playing, but then he like never showed up for any games. So then I started getting this resentment. And then my coach at the time, bought Boone's Farm for us. We went on a softball camping trip and then she'd be arrested now, but we did. I mean, she bought Boone's Farm. And then there was another girl in high school that was a little entrepreneur because she got little Tropicana bottles full of orange juice and made screwdrivers and sold them for a dollar. So I thought that was a ripoff and yet I still bought it anyway. That night was very fuzzy. We were at a campground in Jamestown, and that was my first blackout. And I think I was probably like 16, maybe 15 or 16. What I remember of the night is putting the tent up, and then the next thing I remember is sitting on a picnic table somewhere in the campground, and I went to go stand up and I face planted because I was drinking, but it wasn't happening quick enough. So I drank more, and then I went to go stand up, and I just face planted. And then I woke up the next morning, and that's all that I remember. I don't know where I was. I don't know what happened. I don't know anything. But when I woke up, I felt fine, and I thought that was kind of fun, you know. And most people would not think that, you know. Like I said, to this day, I have no memory of that. So my goal when I drank was to get to that place again. And I drank throughout high school. I ended up running cross country, and one of the guys that ran a couple of years before me was helping our coach out, and he was of age. And so Kay and I were going to a football game, and I said, well, I want a drink. And they're like, well, what do you want? And I said, can we just get like a half a pint of grain? Like, can we, you know, because I don't do the sissy stuff. You know, if you're going to go for it, you go all out. There was no, you know, I don't want to mix anything up. I don't want to do that. So he bought it for us, and there's an elementary school, Montrevet, which Randy knows where that is, Montrevet, and it was underneath the sign of the school under the leaves. And so we went to go get it. My girlfriend put it in her purse. Again, you could not. I don't think you get into a football game today and have that. But I think I drank some there, and then we went to McDonald's afterwards, and I got a drink, and I poured this much out of whatever it was and filled the rest of it up with grain. Drank that, had bed spins, thought that was fine, woke up the next morning, was totally fine. Didn't have a hangover, didn't get sick, nothing. Totally fine. So I thought this was fun. You know, so when I got to when I found out I went to college, I picked the college by how far away it was from home. I applied to one school, and I got in, and that was Ferrum College, which is in Franklin County, Virginia, which is the moonshine capital of the world. They made a movie after it. And so I went there, and there was like freedom. You know, my dad's drinking continued to progress. He knew one of the basketball coaches at school, and I was friends with a lot of different people. I mean, I had a core group of friends that I hung out with, but I wasn't just an elitist to that. Like, I knew, like, people on the football team. I knew the cheerleaders. I knew the nerdy, you know, it was whatever. And so the coach, my dad kept saying, well, I don't want you to go to Beach Week because you're going to drink. And I, like, was just laughing, like, okay, you know, like, he hasn't stopped me before, so why is he going to stop me now? And the only reason I got to go to Beach Week is because Coach Baker said to my dad, you know, if you've raised her right, then, which he'd never raised me, but, you know, I mean, you know, just let her go to the beach, basically. So my dad was really big in saying that was the only reason I got to go. So I got to go. I drank some when I was there. Nothing really bad happened. But then when I got away to college, my dad rented a Lincoln Town Car to take me to school because he had to look good. And this was when you could get probably about 10 bodies in the trunk of the Lincoln Town Car because it was just this massive boat. So he drove it up in the mountains of Ferrum. I don't even want to know the amount of gas that he spent driving this vehicle. But I think they were there all 30 minutes, just unloaded the car, and I'm like, I'm good, see you later, bye. Like, get away. Like, I did not want to have anything else to do with them. And that's when my drinking started taking off. You know, I didn't have anybody waking me up for school anymore. I didn't have anybody telling me what to do at all. So I started drinking, drank the way I wanted to, started drinking on the weekends. A girl that lived down the hall from me gave me a fake ID. She was about 5'4" and weighed about 95 pounds, and my thigh weighs that, and I'm 5'10". So we don't look anything alike, but I still got in to the bar. There was one bar at Ferrum, it was called The House, and it's one-stop shopping. You could get whatever you wanted there. And I remember going there, and I hadn't perfected drinking and standing upright, but I learned how to perfect that because I used to fall down a lot when I drank. And, you know, I just thought I was having a great time. And the next blackout that I remember having, because of the way my birthday fell, I was 17 when I went to school and turned 18 while I was there, and they kept moving the drinking age, which really irritated me. The legal drinking age, I'll put it that way. So I went to, I went out, and every Thursday night we would go out, and I went out, and I got so intoxicated I couldn't sit up straight in the chair. I tried to blow beer across the table. Like, I just could not function. I mean, I do remember doing that. And I went, and that's what I woke up the next morning, and I just passed out. And I had brownouts where I don't remember parts of the evening. And then I'm standing in line at lunch, and all these people kept coming up to me and talking to me. And my friends are like, who is that? I'm like, I don't know who that is. Well, you were talking to him all night. No, I wasn't. Yes, you were. And these probably four or five people came up to me and started talking to me, and I had absolutely no clue who they were. None. And my friends were like, but you talked to him all night. I don't know who you are. And Ferrum is a small school. I mean, it's a pretty small school. It's bigger now, but it was pretty small when I went there. And I had an awesome experience there. I absolutely loved it. I did graduate. I mean, I have plenty of stories of being drunk in between and doing stupid crap. And one night I had gone out to I lived in the Virgin Vault. It was all girls dorm. And then that's what they called it. It was all freshmen. And then beside us was the all-guys dorm, and then behind us was an all-male dorm. And I remember there was a parking lot that was, like, in between that everybody parked in. And I remember going up the back steps to get into my room, and I had my key. And I remember standing there just cussing like a sailor because I was so mad I couldn't get in my room. And I had my key in the door, and the door wouldn't open, and I'm cussing. And the girl across the hall from me comes over and she's like, Babs, what is going on? I'm like, I cannot get into my room. I don't know what's wrong. And she said, look where you are. And I was standing in my room with the door open, with the key in the door, thinking that I was still in the hallway. And I remember going, oh, this is weird. Okay. You know, and I went to bed and never thought anything of it. I did get alcohol poisoning my freshman year. We had a grain party. I don't know what it was with drinking grain, but I really like that. We had a grain party. A bunch of my friends did, and we soaked the fruit for, you know, like the day before. And I remember eating the fruit, thinking that it tasted just like the fruit. Didn't taste any different to me. And I probably had two big college cups, probably within about an hour and a half. I drank that. I really would get very angry when I drank, so sometimes it wasn't good. Like, I would throw beer bottles at random people. The long necks, you get a hold on them well. And so I decided I was going to leave this party, and so I left, and I pushed a football player across the hallway and because his back was to me and he wouldn't get out of my way. And then he came back like this and then realized it was a girl. And he goes, oh, she didn't push me. And I'm like, you know, I just kept on walking. And we had a fire drill that night. And I think I probably passed out around 11 at night because when the fire drill happened, it was like 1 in the morning. And it was Ferrum is up in the mountains, and it gets really, really bitter cold up there. And I'm trying to walk outside and, like, not much. You know, and my roommates, my friends are pulling me back in, throwing clothes on me. And the next day, one of the girls, we went to her boyfriend's hunting trailer to have a keg party because it was his birthday. And I remember going, like, I am not drinking anything. And I remember getting back in the car, and it was weird. It was like I almost got drunk all over again. And so I thought if I smoked a cigarette, that would help it, which just made me want to vomit even more, actually, because I don't smoke. Recreationally, I smoke. But anyway. And so we get out of the car, and I fall out of the car. Because I was, I felt like I was completely drunk again. And I remember saying, I said, I just need to lay down. And I walked into this trailer, and it looked like something out of Deliverance. I mean, it looked scary, but they had a bed there. And I didn't even care what had been on it. I said, I've got to lay down. And the only thing I ate all day was a piece of bread. And then I don't remember the rest of the day. I just remember I was back in my room. And for 4 or 5 days, I felt that way. Like, I really couldn't get up. I couldn't do much. And I should have gone to the hospital, you know. But I didn't, and I thought, maybe I need to slow down a little bit. So, you know, a month later, I was drinking again. You know, I would get money for my birthday for my mom or whatever, and the first thing I would do was I would buy alcohol. I would buy a six-pack, and that was the pregame. And I sat on the cooler the beer was in because nobody was going to get that. You know, we would go out and drink, and I would feel anxious, like, well, what are y'all going to have? Like, that's not going to be enough, you know. And even before I stopped drinking in my 30s, if I went out with my girlfriends and there were four of us and we were at a bottle of wine, I'm like, what are y'all drinking? And they thought I was joking. I'm like, dude, I'm so serious. Like, and I remember just slugging it back so we'd have to get another bottle. I would feel anxious, like there's not going to be enough. So I graduated college and did not want to go home because my dad's drinking was just, you know, ridiculous at this point. So I applied to graduate school. And I really did not want to go. And I don't know if you're like me, but if there's something I really don't want to do, I find every excuse in the world not to do it. I procrastinate. I just won't do it. And I didn't want to go to school, but I didn't want to go home. And I didn't know what else to do, so I went to school. They only accepted 10 people in the program. And it was, I wanted to be a therapist, a mental health therapist, which I did become. But anyway, so I got into this program, and school was always incredibly important to me. It was a lot of my identity. And I wasn't, like, in honor society. I wasn't on the dean's list, but it was really important that I did well in school. And I got to this place, and my drinking just took off. I didn't want to go to class. I was drinking almost every day. The people that I lived with, I didn't know. Because it was one of those things, you know, you go to the bulletin board, like, oh, they need a roommate, you know, and so one of the girls that lived there, her name was also Barbara, and she was the local coke and weed dealer, and little did I know that the DEA was watching her flipping house. And I wondered why they freaked out when somebody would knock on the door and I would say, come in, and there's a huge bong sitting on the table, you know. I didn't understand why they flipped out. Because I wasn't used to that, the drug culture. Like, I wasn't used to that. I started thinking about dealing for a while because I needed some extra money. I didn't do that, though. But my drinking just kept escalating, and so I decided to get a job in a bar. And I worked there for a while, and I felt like in some weird way that gave me some kind of status. Like, I don't know, in my warped thinking, I don't know why I felt that way, but I did. And I was not doing well in school. So at the end of that year, I got a 2-page letter telling me I needed to leave and that no matter how hard I worked, I would never bring my grades up to their standards so I would graduate. And so it twisted around to it was all about them. They don't know who they are. Don't you know who I am? And I don't understand why these people are doing this and blah, blah, blah. So I was the total victim in that. So I moved back to Richmond. And the only thing that really controlled my drinking was the fact that I was living with my mom. Because there was something about coming home drunk to her house that I said I would never do. I ended up doing it. But I said that I never wanted to do that because I saw my brother do that one time. And I remember how upset she got, and I thought, I can't do that. But my rationale was I can hold my liquor better than him, and so I did it. and then I decided I need to get married because that's going to fix everything. So I had started dating this guy that I went to high school with, and he was it's really weird. After we divorced, all my friends were like, I could never see you with him. Like, why did you marry him? He's very straight-edged, I mean, painfully so, cannot hold liquor at all. He has these big white chiclet teeth, and he's just like Mr. Perfect. And he thinks so as well, even to this day. But I thought that would, like, okay, so I'm going to get married, and I'm going to do what everybody's supposed to do. So I got married very shortly after we got married. I got pregnant. Our wedding anniversary was on the 12th of 1 month, and 3 days later, our daughter was born. And so that really, I didn't drink when I was pregnant, but I still felt I wasn't good enough. His parents are very entitled, and they went to high school with my dad. And so it was like that generational, like, we don't like you because of who your dad is stuff. Because my dad was really rebellious and was a drinker, and he was a bootlegger and did all the kind of stuff, you know, came from the wrong side of the tracks in Richmond, and my ex's family came from the right side of the tracks. So it was just this weird crap going on. So I never felt like I was good enough. And so we bought a house, had another child. And I remember we had been married about 5 years. And my drinking really almost stopped. Like, I was able to go out and have, like, a glass of wine. And I didn't enjoy it because I had to control it. I felt like I did. But I remember... when my second child was born, a couple of years later, I kept thinking, you know, this, I don't know, I was like, I woke up from a bad dream. Like, what did you do? And I remember sitting on the edge of the bed going, what is this, like, really my life? Like that Talking head song, you know, like I just did not know, like, what happened. So, I wanted to go back to school and get my master's degree, and he was pretty supportive of me doing that. And I was really fortunate enough that I didn't have to work at all, and I was able to go to school full time, and I did that, and I finished my master's degree. My drinking had kind of tapered off a little bit, and what I specialized in with my master's is drug and alcohol education, and so I had all this knowledge, therefore I could not be an alcoholic. So I graduated, and before I graduated, I had asked him for a divorce, because I just didn't want to be married anymore. It was that irritable, restless discontent. It was everybody but me. And so we got divorced. And then I was this single mother starting over in the food chain and making $25,000 a year. And how am I going to support my kids? He paid the mortgage. He paid some bills, and he helped out. But still, I can remember going to the grocery store with $40 for, like, 2 weeks going, how am I going to feed my kids? Like, I don't know how I'm going to do that. So there wasn't a lot of forethought. I was really impulsive with things, you know, and it ended up, you know, working out. You know, I got a job where I did my internship with, and there was a woman that worked there who at the time had been 10 years sober. My drinking got to the point that I would drink only on weekends when I didn't have the kids. And then I drew a line in the sand that said, I'll never drink with my kids in the house. And then, you know, what happens? Cross that line. Okay, I'm never going to drink when they're awake. So I'll drink when they're asleep. So I was sitting in my kitchen drinking, and I had a thought of what if something happened, I had to take him to the hospital. What would I do? And the very next thought was, you've driven drunker than this before, you'll be fine. I would lay my life down for my kids. I would never put them in danger. But that thought at that time was very logical to me. I can remember being at Ferrum, which is some of the roads we were on coming up here were very much like that two-lane winding roads, beautiful mountains in the background. And I can remember driving. I came out of a blackout driving somebody else's car on these mountains. I did not know where I was. I didn't know who was in the car with me except for one girl that was sitting beside me. And I ended up getting where I needed to be. You know, and I look back and see that that was my higher power taking care of me, because there's no reason that I should and anybody else in that vehicle should be alive. I mean, there's none. I learned how to drive my first stick shift while I was drunk. One of my friends hot-wired it for me, and I drove in a parking lot, and that's how I learned to drive a stick shift when I was intoxicated. I thought I did really well, and I don't really remember a whole lot of it. I got intoxicated pretty bad one night when my ex and I were still together, and it was about 4 o'clock in the morning, and I had veered off the road of this like four-lane highway in Richmond, and I had a friend with me, and we went to graduate school together, and she was staying at my place, and we had gone out drinking, and now I was in school in graduate school with people that were at least 10 years younger than me, and they would invite me to a keg party, but that was beneath me. But yet I would go out to all the bars in Chaco Bottom, knew all the bartenders' names. I got my belly button pierced. I thought I was like hot shit. I just thought I had arrived. And I had to call him because my car had a flat tire. And this is before cell phones. And so I got a ride from somebody. I walked in front of his car and said, "Can you take me somewhere?" And the thought with that was, I have a really good life insurance policy, so if something happens to me, the kids will be fine. I mean, that's how I thought. It was not rational. It was very black and white thinking. And so I went up to the drive-thru window at McDonald's and knocked on the drive-thru window, and they're in there, like, making biscuits at, like, 4 o'clock in the morning looking at who. And I'm like this on the window. I need you to let me in because I need to use the phone. And they're pointing behind me, and there's a payphone. I'm not using a payphone. I need to come inside. I ended up using the payphone. Never once did I think to myself, my kids are going to have to come with him to pick me up. And they were 2 and 4, 5, something like that. So he came to pick me up. I tried to blow it off like it was no big deal. And I will never forget the look on my daughter's face going, "Mommy, what's wrong? Why are we up so early? Why is it dark outside? Daddy said something's wrong. Are you okay?" And we got back to where the car was. The state police was there because I left my black car in the curve of the road with no blinkers on. My purse was in the car. It was unlocked. The keys were in the ignition. And I can be very defiant. And one of the few times I think I actually listened to what my husband said at the time was, he got out of the car and saw the police, and he said, "Don't get out of the car." And I said, "Okay." And I sat. And I've never had a DUI. I've never been to jail. You know, those are all the yets that have not happened to me. But I have no doubt that if I go back out again, that they will. I'm not immune to this, you know. So I started, so I'm sorry, I'm going back and forth. So I ended up getting a job where I did my internship at a addiction treatment center. And I'm still drinking at this point. I had patients that I was working with that had more time in sobriety than I did because I didn't think I had a problem. And then I started talking to my friend, who'd been sober 10 years at that point, about my drinking. And she said, "Why don't you get an evaluation?" And I said, "Okay." So I go get an evaluation. And the woman said, "Well, it doesn't sound like you have a drinking problem." Yes. Now, I didn't tell her the whole story. I know, it's a shock. It's amazing. Why would I lie about that, right? I didn't tell her the whole story, so she couldn't give me an evaluation based on what I was saying because I was lying to her. So I started talking to Gail about this and started talking about my drinking, and she did the evening group and I did the morning group. And she said, "Why don't you come in and sit in group?" Because I was there doing my notes or something. So we sat in group, and there was this exercise she did, and they talked about all the consequences of your drinking, and you marked off on this sheet of paper everything that's happened to you while you were drinking. And I was at the bottom of the list. And I just sat there going, this, but I filled it out. So it's not like I can't blame anybody. And that was one of those first moments of clarity I had where I was starting to understand the truth of my condition, that I am an alcoholic and I do have a problem. Unfortunately, that is not when I stopped drinking. It was shortly after that though, but, the last drink that I took, I was out with two coworkers, former coworkers, that I had, and, I wasn't going to drink that night. I didn't want anything to drink because I was getting to the point where I'm like, I can't do this anymore. And they said to me, don't you want something to drink? I said, no, I'm good. And they kept on. And, okay, fine. So I had a Corona with a lime, which I drank all the time. And I left half of it. And I pushed it away. And I said, I'm done. And I think they thought I was just, like, done for the night, you know. But, like, I never left alcohol. Like, if somebody left alcohol, you were going to get I was going to ask you, why are you leaving it? And do you want it? Can I finish it? I don't understand why you're like, it didn't make sense to me. So I left it and I said, I'm done. And I went to work the next day and, I said, I need to go to a meeting. And there was a meeting they had in Richmond. It was BYOL, bring your own lunch. It was a noon meeting. And there were a lot of people that worked in downtown Richmond, like in the financial district. And, so I went down there and picked up my first white chip. And so I started going to meetings. I've never been to treatment. Didn't mean I didn't need to go, you know. And the first 3 months that I was dry, I did not have a sponsor. And so that got insane really quickly because you know what we're like when we don't drink and don't have a solution. My choices were I'm going to kill myself or I'm going to drink again. And I can remember there's a suspension bridge in Richmond that goes over the James River. And I can remember walking with – men had a lot of power in my life back then. I was – a lot of power. And I was dating this one guy, and he was an earth person. And I was walking across this bridge. And the next thing I remember, he's standing in front of me with his hands on my shoulder going, what are you talking about? And what I thought I was just up in my head apparently made its way out of my mouth. And I looked over, because I was looking over, and I said, I wonder if I could kill myself if I just ran and jumped. And apparently I said it out loud and scared the crap out of him. And I said, well, I mean, it probably would work. I mean, we're pretty high up, and the water's not that deep. And he's looking at me like I am crazy, and probably in that moment I was. But I was that hopeless that I did not feel like I could manage my life sober because I didn't know how to do it. Well, I didn't know how to do it because I wasn't listening to anybody. I was going to meetings late. I was leaving early. I wasn't talking to anybody. I didn't have a sponsor. And AA doesn't work. But I'm the one that's not doing anything. So I had gone to this meeting on Sunday morning. It's the Roundhouse in Richmond. If you ever get a chance to go, it's an amazing meeting. There's so much sobriety there. I mean, it's just amazing. And I was meeting Gail there. And there was a woman that I had had an experience a couple weeks before where a young woman had shared her story. And I was, like, looking around for the cameras because, you know, that moment when you hear your story from somebody else, that was the moment I had with this woman. And she was from out of town. She was around my age. And I remember just sitting there crying. And I'm not a crier. Like, I hate crying. Even to this day, I'm not a fan of it. And I just sat there and cried, you know. And that again, was another surrender that I had. And so there was another woman that spoke there. Her name was Claire, and she was about this tall. She had the most angelic face of anybody I've ever seen. And I remember going, I want to look like that. Because I don't feel like that inside. It was like a constantly waking up with anxiety, constantly waking up with this sudden impending doom that something bad was going to happen. I couldn't manage anything. My life was a complete wreck. I couldn't do anything. I couldn't manage anything. I couldn't think straight. I couldn't sleep because the rats kept rolling around in my head, and I kept having all these thoughts of, like, my head just wouldn't shut up. And that's one of the things alcohol did for me. It shut my head up. So I looked at Gail and I said, I have to have a sponsor. And she's like, no kidding, you know. And so Claire was walking behind me and I just turned around. I stuck my hand out and I said, I'm Barbara and I'm an alcoholic and I have to have a sponsor today. I have to have a sponsor. Will you sponsor me? And she just kind of stopped because I stuck my hand at the point where, like, she had to, like, walk around me. Like, I was, you know. And so we exchanged phone numbers and you know, we started working together. It took me a year to do my fourth step because I was terrified. I don't know how I stayed sober that year. I do. But, you know, at that time, I didn't understand how I stayed sober. I carried my white chip everywhere I went. Claire told me that if I put it in my mouth and it melted, then I could drink again. Didn't work. I still was going out with my friends, and none of my friends really knew that I was an alcoholic. They did not know. So I would go out, and I went out with my one friend, Susan, and she ordered a glass of wine, and I ordered a beer, and I had my white chip in my hand, and I was just, like, clenching it like this the whole night. And bless you. And for some reason, the waitress just kind of kept standing there talking to her. I don't know if Susan knew her or whatever. And then I said, no, let me get a near beer, which those are nasty and disgusting. But and then before she left, I said, can I just have an iced tea? And I didn't drink that night. Didn't think about calling my sponsor and telling her that, processing it with her. I didn't think about doing any of that stuff. But I went over to Claire's and did the third step with her. And I had no idea what that looked like. And she goes, well, why don't we get on our knees? I'm like, for what? And we were in her dining room. I mean, there was nobody there. And I said, but I might as well have been buck naked on 29. I mean, I felt like everybody knew that I was there. And she held my hands, and we did the third step prayer. Well, she said it because I didn't know what it was. And I remember I walked out of there, and that was the first time that I felt, like, even hopeful that something was going to be different. That was the first time, and I had been sober, I don't know, 6 or 7 months at that point, maybe. So I ended up going through the steps. she was very involved at district, and so when I went over to do my fifth step, it looked like one of these long spreadsheets. You know, I had this vivid dream that it was going to fly out of my car, and somebody was going to see it. Like, no, but who's going to care? But, you know, I'm that important that somebody clearly cannot read that. So we sat at our dining room table, and I had everything laid out the way she told me to do, and she looked over at me, and I thought I did this great job, and she's like, nope, you got to work on that one some more. So then she hands me a legal pad, so I finished doing it. And I looked at her, and I said, I'm not leaving until this is done. And she's like, okay. Of course I wasn't going to leave. But to me, I thought that was like a big deal. And so she had people, you know, she showed me what it was like to be a sober woman active in AA. She, during the time when I was writing all this stuff out, she's like, I'm going to have people coming over, picking up stuff for district, blah, blah, blah. And I didn't even know what that meant, but these people would come in and they would say hello to me, and I just kept writing. I didn't care at that point. Like I didn't care if 50 people were in her house. I was going to get this done. So I finished that, and then I went to. We were working on my amends list, and there was a woman that I worked with that I didn't like, probably because she reminded me of me. And so I played a joke on her, which actually was incredibly cruel. I had made up stationery and typed this letter up that she had won this big award, and it was like all BS. Like none of that happened. And what ended up happening is she took the letter to our boss, and then our boss put it in the company newsletter. Then the pastor from her church shows up to see, I worked in a nursing home at the time, to see one of our nursing home residents, and she shows it to him, and so he just happens to be on the way to Northern Virginia to the printer for the bulletin in the church, so they were going to put that there. So by noon, all this had happened, and I knew nothing of it. And then one of the coworkers that I took over and totally, you know, it's got to be to the extreme, she said, we have to tell her this is not real. I said, it's April Fool's Day. Like, why can't somebody take a joke? Seriously, I don't understand. And she said, well, I'll go ahead and take the blame. And I was like, all right. And I watched her walk outside, take the blame, shoulder the blame for everything. And I watched this woman just break down and start crying. And I still thought, I don't know why she can't take a joke. Like, this is stupid. And so she found out that I did it, didn't speak to me for 4 months. I didn't really care. And so then as I'm telling my sponsor about this, she's just kind of looking at me like I went into much more detail about what I did. And so I said, you know, she doesn't really want to talk to me anymore, so I can't really do an amends. And she said, oh, but you can. You can write a letter and keep it in your glove box of your car. And if you see her, hand it to her. And that way you can honor what she asked you for. And I was like, all right. Imagine that, honoring what somebody asked you to do. Wrote the letter. She read everything I wrote. Approved it. Stuck it in an envelope. Stuck it in my glove box. I had forgotten about it. And I was walking from work across the parking lot to go to a Tackle Express to get my Diet Coke and Runts that I ate every day. Like, I was eating, like, boatloads of sugar at the time. And I'm walking in, and there's literally nobody in the parking lot except for her. And I was standing there, and I couldn't hide anywhere. This is, like, this big parking lot. The gas pumps are here, and I'm like, we were this far apart, and she acted like she didn't even know who I was. I mean, I wouldn't have either. if I, if somebody did it to me, I wouldn't have done, I would have treated them the same way. So I walked in, got my Diet Coke and my runs. I walked out, and she's standing there talking to her husband, telling them that I could hear her saying, well, I saw Barbara walk in there. Did you see her in the store? So I didn't think she would actually stand there and wait for me to go across the parking lot to get the letter out of my car. So I made an amends, and she just said thank you. And I've never seen her since. But I called my sponsor, told her about it. I said, I didn't do what you told me, but this is why, you know, I thought I was going to get in big trouble. But so that was kind of the first awakening for me to really take a look at how my actions impacted other people, because I never, ever thought my actions impacted other people, ever. And if I did something for you, there was a rope attached to it because you were going to owe me one day. It could be a big fat rope or it could be a little teeny thread, but you were going to owe me. And you were going to know if I did something nice, because I had to tell everybody if I did something really nice. Because I needed everybody's approval to make the inside feel better. And that's what a relationship with a higher power has done for me, that I don't need that anymore. My sponsor that I have now calls it a God-shaped hole. You know, you're filling it up with everything but your higher power. I had Claire for probably about 4 years, I guess. And then I got in a relationship, because I was not emotionally sober, with a guy that said he was sober, but he wasn't. And he was really violent and mean. And I had to go to the hospital because he put his hands on me. And I remember Claire saying to me, if you continue in this relationship with this man, I can't sponsor you. And I said, okay. And I hung the phone up and I never sponsor anymore. That relationship ended, and every meeting I went to talked about sponsorship for 2 years. I didn't drink, but I wasn't exactly happy either. There was something missing, because I would hear people talking about their relationship with their sponsor and do step work and everything, and there was just something that was missing. So the sponsor that I have today, a lot of people in here know who she is. Her and her husband had just moved back from North Carolina. And there was a meeting Saturday morning that I would go to, and it was from 10 to 11, and there was a lot of sobriety. And I would go there, and I felt at home, and I felt comfortable there. And I had a home group and name only. Like, I went to the meeting, but I didn't participate. I didn't do anything. I didn't have a service position. I did nothing but pick up a flipping coin and take up air. I mean, I didn't do anything there. And I kept looking at her husband going, God, where have I seen her before? Because this is an active woman. I do not know where she finds the time, but she is active. I mean, she sponsors like 13 people. I mean, I don't know how she does it. And I remember talking to her, because I would see her in meetings, and I'm like, nobody's that flipping happy. Like, nobody's that happy. Because she would say, there's no place I'd rather be on a Saturday morning. And I'd be like, well, I'd rather be asleep. Like, what do you mean you don't want to? So she was the one I asked to be my sponsor. And she was the first sponsor that I had that took me through the big book, starting with the blank page. That's where she started. And she would meet with me every Saturday morning after that meeting for an hour, and we would go through the big book. Went through the steps again. And my recovery just took off after that point, because I understood what this book talked about. I found myself in there. You know, and I was more eager and desperate with 6 years of sobriety than I was when I had one. And if she would have told me to go stand in that corner and spit nickels and it'll keep you sober, I would have done it. Without a doubt, I would have done it. I stayed in her back pocket. And my recovery completely took off. I am not the girl that walked in here that I am today. I'm not that person anymore. I still want what she has. She yanks me up when she needs to. And when she does, it's usually pretty scary, because I've really messed up when she does that. But she has every right to do that, every single right. We stay current. She knows everything about me. She knows about the crazy thoughts that go on in my head. I work in a treatment center today. I've been there for 5 years. It is in Williamsburg. And there's a Sonic that's not too far from there. And I really like cherry limeades. And so every day when I would drive home in the summer, I would stop by there and get a cherry limeade. Well, there was a big sign out there that says lemon drop slushies. Well, you know what I started thinking about was vodka. And the next thing I knew is before I ever left work, I would start thinking about vodka. Like, so I called Christy and I said, okay, so I get this weird crap going on in my head. And I tell her all this stuff, and she goes, well, don't go to Sonic anymore. Never entered this brain. Not once. Now, would I have relapsed? I don't know, but I wasn't willing to take that risk. I was not willing to do that. I had an experience probably, I was earlier this year, and poor Randy was the witness to it. We'd gone out for one of his best friend's birthday, and we were at an Italian restaurant, and there was wine everywhere. Everywhere. And I got so immobilized with fear, I couldn't eat. I couldn't talk, which anybody that knows me knows that that's really bad because I can talk paint off a wall. And I just was so immobilized with fear. Just, I was terrified. And so after everybody ate, I just looked at her. I'm like, I have to leave. I just have to leave. And physically, my back was against the wall because of the way the seating was in the room. You know, and somebody over here was drinking, and then somebody over there was drinking. And they have every right to because they're not an alcoholic. It's none of my business anyway. You know, they're all earth people. They can do whatever they want to do. So I remember I left there in this panic, and it was raining outside, and I was calling my sponsor, and I left her this long message, and then I called somebody else. And another benefit of having a fellowship, because I got a bunch of people on my phone I can call and talk to. And when I get desperate enough, I don't care what time it is, I'm going to call you. So my sponsor called me back. She's like, what happened? And I told her, and I'm like, I'm freaking out. Do I want to drink? Do I not want to drink? I don't know what to do, blah, blah, blah. And so she told me what to read in the book. And I prayed and I read and I fell asleep like a baby. Woke up the next morning and that was gone. I don't know what that was. I don't know why God saw fit to do that. It'd be nice if I had a little memo as to why, but I don't know why that happened. But because I have a sponsor and I'm current with her and I know what I need to do, that was remedied pretty quickly. And it was terrifying while I was in that because the last thing on earth I want to do is drink. It's not even an option for me. And I've been through more painful things in my recovery than I've been through, you know, when I was still drinking. My son is 20. My daughter's 24. She's getting married in 4 weeks. And that's been a very spiritual journey for mom. My son was hospitalized twice because he wanted to commit suicide. And it was, you know, the first person I called after I dropped him off was my sponsor. I got her voicemail. I heard her voice, and I cried so hard. She said she couldn't even understand what I was saying, but I didn't care. I had to talk to her and let her know what was going on, and she helped me through that immensely. And if I didn't have a sponsor, I mean, I don't know if I would have drank or not, but I certainly wasn't willing to take that risk. You know, I have a relationship today with my kids that is amazing. They tell me things I really wish they wouldn't tell me sometimes, but they do. And I'm incredibly blessed. I'm very blessed that God saw fit to put a wonderful man in my life that I had nothing to do with. My picker's broke. I didn't pick him. That's probably why it's working, because I didn't pick you. You know, and I have a great relationship with my mom. My dad died when I was 28, I guess, of alcoholism. He was 56 when he died. They had him in a medically induced coma. And, you know, I didn't stop drinking after I saw all that. I wasn't sober then. A couple years later, I got sober. But, you know, my life today is better than anything I could have ever imagined. Like, I could have never planned my life to be the way it is. I go to sleep at night and I'm at peace. I don't have the rats running around my head anymore. I have a relationship with a higher power. I have great relationships with my friends and family. And I'm more busy today than I was. And I can't imagine doing anything else, you know. And it's all because of my willingness and my desperation to do what I need to do. As somebody that said they were never going to be an alcoholic, I'm really grateful that I am. Thanks.